favorite quote from my favorite film, Every Man Dies, but Not Every Man Really Lives. It's good that it's hard because you can look back on that one moment and then no matter what you're doing now, it's like, well, I got through that.
I did that. You summited Mount Everest.
And so I quit work 18 months ago. No idea if it was physiologically possible.
Wow.
So we literally replicated the first climb of Everest in history with the longest climb of Everest in history.
Look, here we are. Mitch,
works,
welcome.
Mate. Thanks for having me. So I won't stop doing this.
This is exactly my issue. I was like, right, I'm going to get one guest on that's just not going to stop spinning.
Well, you chose the one with ADHD.
And the one who literally admitted to me he can't sit still at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mitch Hutchcraft. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, yeah.
Cheers, yeah, because I didn't realise it was Mitch Hutchcraft, because obviously your socials are Mitch Hutch.
Yeah. I get, just a bit long-winded. So yeah. We just broke it down there through some advice from Molly and Stan. So
I'm just going to rattle off what you have done. Because cool. I don't think people quite realise the lengths that you have gone to here, and how you are stood here or sat here today in one piece is remarkable.
Cheers,
but let me just roll through the credentials here. So 35K swim across the English Channel, a 12,000 kilometre cycle across Europe and Asia, a 900 kilometre run to Nepal, a 360 kilometre trek to Everest Base Camp, and then you summited Mount Everest. Is that correct?
Pretty much, bang on. Yeah, I mean, it was 11,920, so I can't quite claim 12,000. And it was 878K, not quite 900, but yeah, it was pretty mental.
Incredible, mate. Thanks, absolutely mate. Incredible. So look, I just wanted to go from the very top, to be honest. This podcast, I want us to kind of go through the challenge, and you've probably spoken about it so many times since you've got back, but it was a world record attempt, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like unofficially, you know, because I never cared about official stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize it was the longest climb of Everest in history, for example, until all the first triathlons at the top of the world.
Yeah.
All that stuff until about a year after I'd planned it. It was only when my friend said to me, you know, you should really shout about this and you can get some good support for the charity and obviously sponsorship. And I was like, okay. And that's when I just went down that road.
Amazing, man. So look, let's go from the very top. Background, you lost your father age 20.
Yes.
Did this light something inside of you? Because you obviously were in the forces. Mm-hmm. You were an ex-Royal Marine.
Yeah.
When you lost your father, did you continue to serve in the military?
No, that was when I did. So that was the catalyst of the whole thing, which pretty much started it all. So yeah, just turned 20, went to Australia. I was there for 6 months and I got a call like, Dad's got 2 weeks to live. And then I was home and then happened really quickly. And then it was me, like there was me sat back in the gym at home, twiddling my thumbs, not knowing what to do. Just in the gym at the time. I'd just had knee surgery a year before in Australia, 6 months before in Australia, a full knee reconstruction. So I wasn't even meant to be able to join the military. I was told there you wouldn't be able to play tennis again, let alone be in the military, let alone the Royal Marines. But after Dad died, it was something, one of the many things we always spoke and dreamed about. And like, you know, I'd done the eulogy at his funeral and it was, the moral was literally live life. He lived life at 100 miles an hour. Life's too bloody short. So I just sat there at the desk and applied there. And then next year I just trained seven days a week, three times a day and got myself in the position to try and get through. And yeah, somehow managed to be one of the few that got through in one go, which was incredible. And incredible combination of luck and hard work. And then that was it. And then 5.5 years later, fast forward to 2021, and I just left because I'd had enough of it. It was amazing, but mm-hmm. time for a new challenge. All these big itches for adventure in the back of my head, all these dreams, that's all I had to go. I wouldn't change a moment of it because it helped carve the mindset that I had, but it helped improve it.
Yeah. Well, the Royal Marines is such a intensive application process, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Especially physically.
Yeah.
You have, I know someone that did the passing out, which is, for those who don't know, passing out is when you go from training to become a Royal Marine and getting selected to becoming an actual Royal Marine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talk to me about that process. How much did you learn over the course of becoming a Royal Marine?
So much. It just like, yeah, as I said, it just drives home all the stuff that's already there. Basically just makes you comfortable being uncomfortable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, it helps you push past that like 40% rule, you know, and most people think you've got to the edge. You in that whole 32 weeks, 8 month period, you know, seven, 8 months, you just push beyond so many times. And it's, and like this expedition, it is 90% mindset, 90% in your head. You know, the first people to fail and drop by the guys that walk in day one, and they look big,
yeah,
bodybuilder type gym lads. They're the first people to drop.
Well, I've heard this, and it is a great advert for mind over matter, isn't it? Is that something you always had instilled within you, or yeah, was this something that clicked?
No, so it's like, you know, it's the mind that I've always had. It, I think, as a combination of just being like so positive in my life, mm-hmm, and like adventurous and all this, and so it was already there, I think, but like when you join the military or you do anything really hard, it just helps hone and carve that mindset that was there as a foundation already, but then it just teaches you loads of extra stuff and just makes you a lot tougher. Mm-hmm. So thankful for the time I had in there, because the opportunities I had the last 4 or 5 years in doing this and doing this expedition,
amazing,
wouldn't have happened without it, because it directly came off the back of leaving the Marines and doing, mm-hmm, my first big expedition rowing.
We recently saw Will Googe run across Australia in record time, and his story is quite, I feel, similar to yours in some way. He lost his mother when he was quite young. I think he was 23 or 24 when she passed away of cancer. Lost her really suddenly, and he speaks about how this sort of like fire in his belly came from losing his mum and doing his mum proud, and his recent challenge was all for her. Do you think that losing your father has sort of triggered something in your life where you're wanting to see the world more and attack these moments?
Definitely. I can echo what he said exactly. And that's, as I say, probably the main reason this all happened and why I really got deep. I was always had that in me, but it's how you look at things. And that moment, just exactly the same. And I talk about it in my talks and that. It literally sparked a fire.
Amazing.
Sparked that fire deep inside me, which made me go from here to here.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the main motivation, you know, as I'm sure it was also for him, you know, mum, dad is looking down. So we're going to make him proud. Like, mm-hmm, and we won't stop until that happens. We'll die before that happens. So it was just one of these extra things I'd say it's like the main motivation.
Yeah.
The main thing that got me through the really dark times of the 240 days.
Mate, absolutely insane. And I think the length of time you were out there speaks volumes to the magnitude of the challenge. And when you were planning it, so Project Limitless was its title. How did you go about planning the project, and what was the sort of training that went on for this?
It was mad. I mean, the whole thing, I mean, the Everest part, you know, it's literally been 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, my first trip, like it all started back when I was 14, decided I was going to climb Kilimanjaro. So I worked for 2 years laboring with my dad to raise the money to go. So just
even then, your dad's linked to climbing mountains.
Because he was always there, no matter, a completely different person to me, kind of. It wasn't into fitness or like adventures, but you know, he was a farmer, mechanic, mm-hmm, like practical man.
Grafter.
Like, he grafted, man. He absolutely just believed in everything. So he'd done that. And then, so that was my first adventure. Just turned 16. Took me a year to find a company that would take someone less under 18 completely on their own. So I found the company, flew to Africa on my own, climbed Kilimanjaro. Big first step for me. So that's when training started in my head, really. But then really kind of got put on the backbone. The Marines happened. And then it's by pure accident, 3 months after leaving the Marines in 2021, I was working in London, some crappy security work. And my friend said to me, do you want to row across the Atlantic? So next thing you know, we're rowing completely unsupported.
Seven weeks
across an open ocean. And I was basically like 3 hours on, 3 hours rowing, 3 hours resting, 3 hours rowing, 3 hours resting, nonstop for 7 weeks.
Can I just ask about that? Because I've seen people do this before. And a lad I used to play cricket with, him and his brothers rowed across the Atlantic. When you're out there, how anxiety inducing is it when you kind of, let's say you're 100 miles out, there is no turning back.
No, it's mad. Like, and you have that wobble. I'll never forget the only time I had that one kind of like, I shat my pants.
Yeah.
That one moment I was like, oh man, like was as we were leaving Gran Canaria, you know, it was within 6 hours, 7 hours. We lost sight, you know, mm-hmm, and that moment, like you lost sight of land, knowing there was nothing but open ocean and not a single human being or land for nearly 2 months ahead of you. That moment. Oof. But again, this happened with the swim as well, whilst I was swimming the channel.
Yeah.
But I wasn't moving for an hour because the current was pushing me back. It's the only time like I had that blues moment where your belly and your heart just sinks. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you just have to somehow draw on my dad, you know, draw on while you're there. And it's all about channeling adversity into power. That's the whole kind of concept.
I love that.
My book and my talks. And that is it. And somehow I managed to draw on that. And then got a grip of myself. And then as soon as that happened, after that half a day leaving, never happened again. Mm-hmm. I just accepted my fate, accepted, settled in, realized again, all the stuff that gets you through, compartmentalization, all the things that I like to harper on about, but all these things just got us through. But that moment was, absolutely like, whew, big. But that's it. Cause that whole, like, if you think I've got 3,000 miles, nearly 2 months ahead of me of open ocean. It's just bang.
Yeah.
All I did and all anyone has to do in any situation, whether you're doing a 2K walk or an ultra marathon, think of that next tree, think of that next lamppost. That's all I did. I thought, let's get to the end of today. Got to the end of the day. I said, let's get to the end of tomorrow. Next thing you know, nearly you're halfway through a week. And you're like, I'm halfway through the week. Let's get to the end of the week. Did that. And then we were nearly at 400, 500 miles. And it was like, oh, we've done 500 miles already. It's like 20% or like 10% there. And then it just grew and grew and grew and grew.
It's a manifestation of your mind and kind of setting these small boundaries to then tick over, which then create the bigger boundaries.
That's it, almost. Mate. Yeah. And it was just mad. That's where it happened. And it was about halfway through. Just rowing one day, probably about 1,000 miles in. And I just had this light bulb moment. I was, because most mad adventures, you know, people will tell you're born from mad adventures while you're doing them. So I always had this dream to climb Everest from zero, though, to go from sea level to the top of the planet, you know, and then, but also the channel had always been a big, massive, like, motivation of mine, you know, like 5 times more people have climbed Everest than have swam the channel. There's a reason,
wow.
There's a reason for that.
That's incredible stuff.
It's so much tougher, you know, and I was like, wow, like, okay, that was all something I loved. I just remember having a moment, but I don't know why it happened, like a light bulb moment. I thought, if I link the middle bit, it kind of becomes a triathlon.
Yeah.
So then the concept was just born, boom. I said, right, talking to my mate, I was like, what if we could swim the channel and then get on the bike, cycle across the world, 18 countries or whatever it would be, 2 continents, 12,000 km, all the way to India, into the ocean, and then you know, literally ride into the ocean, ditch the bike, or not ditch it, you know, and then go on foot from the ocean, from sea level to Nepal, to Everest, and climb it. And then the more I thought about it, the more like the timings in my head, swimming the channel end of summer,
yeah,
brings you to like, whenever I hit them, would hit the Middle East, wherever that would be November, December, perfect. That is the but time you'd want to be doing that, because you can, but obviously going through the Middle East, Iran, or wherever you'd be going, like we did, Iraq, Middle East, Oman, Saudi, going through there July, August, it would have been like...
Oh, it would have been like 50 Celsius.
So the more I thought about it, it was like, you know, it kind of works out okay, because like it's hard, you know, don't get me wrong, I was still averaging like 140 kilometers for like four months straight on the bike, but it was kind of potentially doable, because it was a race, because I said... day, you know, my race from England to the top of Everest, because I had to get to Everest. I had to get there by this period for the climbing season before, and otherwise it closed. Otherwise that was it.
And the climbing season is kind of like a extended ski season in a way, in terms of that time.
It's like 1 3-week period you can climb Everest.
Oh, really? That small?
Yeah. So the lines will get fixed by like a team, you know, up to the summit, say the second or say the 10th of May or above, or between the 10th and 15th of May, 28th of May, they're taken down. Done, and you can't climb anymore. So I had to get to Everest.
So what
in that time?
We're skipping a fair few stages right now, but just to ask this on kind of ballpark with Everest. If you were to summit Everest without the lines being there, not only would it be incredibly dangerous, but is there any kind of rules on sort of disturbing the land? Because I know it's quite a holy place, isn't it?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it can be done alpine style, which is such a pure way of climbing, which I'd love to do. I've done in the past. I'd love to do more of.
Yeah,
but I think it's legal, but it's always been climbed, you know, apart from the first time, by following the fixed lines all the way up to the summit. So and that's how it works. As soon as they're fixed, you can go, and that's kind of how it works. So I had, going back to that, yes, I had a kind of 4-5 months to get to Nepal, but obviously this was the 12,000 km bike ride. Anything could have happened. I nearly got killed hundreds of times, chased by hundreds of dogs, knocked off my bike in Iraq, run off the road by lorries, you know, the team were like held up at gunpoint, and we were in a car crash that nearly killed us in Turkey. Bureaucracy, visas, food poisoning, so much could have happened, and I knew that. And in the end, the margin was only about 2 weeks. That was it, 10 days, 2 weeks. Wow. When we got there, like cushion room.
Yeah.
So one more major injury or one more big food poisoning, that would have been it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have been done it.
All right, well, let's go from the very top, mate.
Yeah.
So the training that went into getting you ready for that 35 kilometer swim across the English Channel.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that, how that looked.
So I'll just run through it from there. So we had the row, and I thought in my head, right, I need to do a big bike ride, and I need to do swimming, and then I need to climb a mountain. So after the row, that 8 months later, the next year, I then bought a bike, flew it to America, and cycled across the US. So cycled from Florida to California, 5,000 km, because that was like in my head, half of the distance. Like you can do half a marathon, you can do a marathon. So got that in the box. Next was a big mountain expedition in the Himalayas, because you need to do that to even qualify to climb Everest. So the following year, it went row, cycle across the US, and the next year was Amadablam in the Himalayas, a really nice technical, tough, harder than Everest technically.
Yeah.
So I got that in the bag, and then it was just swimming, because I knew 95% of my training for this whole expedition was just swimming, because that was it. There was no point in doing any running or hiking at all, because it would go from a swim straight into a 10 to 12,000 K bike ride. Mm-hmm. So I'd done the tiny little bit of cycling, but not much. So just smash into swimming. So I quit work 18 months ago. No idea if it was physiologically possible, let alone physically or logistically, which Molly will tell you. And then I quit work altogether just to train, because I needed just to train and make thousands of phone calls and go to events.
How are you living when you've quit work?
I mean, literally I'd worked them 8 months to get a little bit of savings to myself to survive them 6 months, knowing that I wouldn't be able to pay for the expedition, but it would give me enough time to work my absolute ass off to try and get it sponsored.
Well, that's the thing. Time is, it unlocks so many.
No, exactly. So many time doors. And dedication and belief. You get 1,000 no's but you'll get one yes eventually. So I quit work and I was swimming like 3 hours a day. And then I found a coach, because I was like, I've never swam for a club or competitively or ever anything. So I was like, I need someone who actually can help us what to do. So I found this not individual, like this little club. Next thing you know, I'm in Croatia doing like an ocean swimming camp training for the channel, like 5 hours a day.
Wow.
And then you have to do a 6 hour swim to even qualify to swim the channel, 6 hours nonstop.
Really? So you have to qualify.
You have to do a 6 hour nonstop swim in water of around 16 degrees without a wetsuit out in either a lake or an ocean.
Okay.
Signed off by someone professional to submit to qualify to swim the channel.
So that's the key word there, submit. Yeah, so yeah, anyone could go up to the edge of the channel and swim across it unassisted. I
mean, theoretically, yeah.
But if you were to die during that, or something was to happen to you, you are then not covered because it hasn't been signed off?
I mean, if you tried to do it, and you didn't have a boat, you'd just drown, and you'd probably.
But I mean,
would
you need a certain permit to ride, like to steer a boat across that body of water someone swimming?
I don't know if it's like a rule saying you can't, but like there's two organisations in the UK that you can officially swim the channel with, you know.
Yeah.
And each of them have got like 10 boats each, 10 pilots that you have to ring and book like three years in advance just to book them.
Wow.
But they're the people you want to do that though, because it doesn't matter if you're the best swimmer in the world. If you try and freeball it without anyone who doesn't know what they're doing, then you're not going to make it. So these guys have been doing.
They know the correct paths and the currents.
They know exactly how to predict the currents. Obviously, it's an S shape. It's not like swimming a straight line.
No.
So they know at what point you need to exactly what speed you need to be going at. They know if you're going to make it basically just by how fast you're swimming. Yeah, you've got customs. Yeah, they sort out the paperwork. They know
that's
like,
crazy. Passport control in the water.
So much. Yeah, pretty much. Like, because at any point the French Coast Guard can come up to you and boat, and everyone has to show their passport.
Wow.
So it's so much stuff that goes into just day one, just into the swim.
And, yeah.
So I trained 5-6 months, just trained my ass off for the swimming. Got back from there, and then it was like just like 2-3 hours a day every day, pretty much, with like hardly any other training.
Were you trying to put on weight? Because I've watched Ross Edgley's videos before, and he says when you're swimming open water and a lot of cold. Risk of hypothermia and things, you want to build up body fat. What was your kind of eating looking like?
At that point I was just eating everything.
Really?
Anything. I mean, not just trying to eat ice cream at McDonald's, but I still have it. Yeah. I still happily have it, but I was just eating so much. I got to about 95, 96 kilos before swimming. Yeah. And I was 95, 96 on day one. And when I summited Everest, I was about 78.
Wow. So what's your 79. Like typical body weight then?
Probably like 85.
Okay. So but, you put on about 10 kilos.
I put on about 10 kilos
swim.
And I lost 16, 17.
Insane.
Yeah. Which was not even as much as they thought, you know. I was working with like Loughborough University sports scientists.
They're incredible.
They were just they were just so intrigued. Is this even humanly possible? Mm. You know, that's why they came on board after a 13,000 K triathlon or whatever of burning 6,000 calories nearly every day for 8 months. Is a body going to be humanly, physically possible to then climb the highest mountain in the world? That was the kind of big question mark.
Yeah.
So I could have got all that way. And then I'm just too fatigued to even, you know, will I die trying, which was the big worry.
Yeah.
And, but the whole thing was getting out there to prove what's possible. And that's what
you've certainly done that.
Yeah.
When you're swimming across, the English Channel,
yeah.
Did you do it unassisted from a wetsuit as well. You did it without one,
yeah,
didn't
no wetsuit, yeah. Skin,
so
yeah.
Why was that?
There's many reasons, you know, like, I mean, I don't really care too much about that. A lot of people, like, it's not officially recognised as a channel swim if you don't wear a wetsuit. But again, I don't necessarily, I think if you want to swim
this, it's harder, surely.
It's harder no matter what. It's harder without a wetsuit, yeah.
Yeah.
It is. But there's also some scientific stuff behind why it's better. You know, like, I think my coaches were just telling me this because they were such, like, purists, you know, who like to swim without a wetsuit. But technically, my thoughts were, I'll do, you know, it's a triathlon at the end of the day. Like, yeah. maybe it's best to wear one. I don't really know. But basically, if you wear like a wetsuit, not only is it the chafing and all that, in a way, you're masking your kind of symptoms. Mm-hmm. The symptoms, say if you're like, I know one guy who was having not heart problems, but say if you get chest pains or something. But if you've got a wetsuit on that's like chafing your nipples, for example, all this, you won't feel it. You won't be able to hear your body. You won't be able to communicate how you're feeling. Little things that happen.
And did he end up having a heart attack?
I'm not sure exactly what happened, but that's how my coaches, I remember them explaining to me. You know, it's like putting on a big rubber mask.
Yeah.
And you need, because the key thing is, you know, to 10 to 20 hour swim, you need to be communicating always. Mm-hmm. Are you feeling cold? Are you feeling hot?
Yeah.
How is this? How's that feeling?
And how are you fueling during the water?
So every 30 minutes on the dot, they basically chuck you like a little bottle on a bit of string and you just literally like float 10 seconds, neck it.
So with carb mix in there and stuff.
Every time it would be a bit different. Half a banana as well, maybe.
Okay.
So yeah, but to give you an idea of like every 30 minutes. So I had like 36 feeds.
Oh my
18
word.
Hours, 19 minutes. It was the worst weather of the entire season. But it was horrible.
How's your body looking after being in the water for that long?
It was just ridiculous. The last 6 hours, genuinely, was just trying not to drown. You know,
yeah.
Modern Stanwood, it was not nice to watch. Like it wasn't swimming. My right shoulder had seized completely. Any tendonitis in my wrists,
yeah,
and like it was just, I'd aspirated and inhaled so much water from the weather, because the weather had come in.
Mm-hmm.
It was bad. Like it was wind state like 4 to 5. There's like five. I think it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, normally if it's 2 or above, the boats wouldn't even leave Dover Harbour if it was mm-hmm. above 2. And the last 5 hours, it was like 4 to 5.
I do remember in the video you really struggling towards the back end. You mentioned that current moment where you're just getting pushed back essentially and making no
progress.
That was
about halfway through, and even then wasn't as bad. It got twice as bad as that for the last 5 hours.
Wow.
5 hours, and that genuinely was like, as I said, it was just trying not to drown. I think if it was 1K longer, I probably would have died.
I'm going to ask you this now.
We had to be pulled out of the water, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, surviving that without a wetsuit and unassisted is an incredible feat in itself. But look, before we'll get onto the Everest stuff later on.
Yeah,
but
no.
Would you say swimming across the channel is harder than climbing Everest?
Yeah.
Really?
I'd say so. It all depends like what you work best at. That's one intense, one session, you know, one non-stop. You know, because even when you climb an Everest or went the whole process, you know, you've got assistance. You've got your Sherpa or your people with you. You can still kind of just take a minute to catch your breath. For example, you know, in the channel, you just can't do that really. You can go on your back and maybe try and float before carrying on. But it's just, in terms of intensity, definitely like the single hardest day of my life, like by far. Harder than any day in the Marines. But it was good. I'm so thankful for it. Thankful for it, because I was meant to swim 5 or 6 hours quicker than that. I was on for like a 13 hour swim or 12. But because of the conditions, it just made it so much harder. But every day past that was easier. I just always thought back to that moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I'm so thankful it was so tough, because it just made the rest of it like, just so much better. Not better, but as I say, anyone, any life, anything that happens in life to you, anything that happens tough, really tough, just think, you know, it's good that it's hard, because you can look back on that one moment, and then no matter what you're doing now, it's like, well, I got through that.
I did that.
So I'm going to be fine.
Yeah.
And that got me through most of the rest of the expedition.
Did you face a lot of jellyfish?
Only a few.
Okay.
We swam past a few. I did not, I remember a few coming over me, but I never actually got stung.
Oh, okay.
I got stung loads down in Devon when I was training.
Yeah.
Ironically, I didn't get stung once across
the whole
channel.
Ross Edgley, he's swimming across around the whole of Iceland at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's insane. Like, he faced like thousands of jellyfish in one section.
Yeah.
It's incredible how he's doing that.
Yeah, no, it's great.
So
he
swim
around his face. At least he's got a wetsuit on.
Yeah. Right, so swim complete.
Yeah.
You get to the shore of France.
Yeah, and then I'm broken.
Broken. How much recovery time did you have?
I was wanting to have just a couple of days to get things around, but it was that bad. Like, I couldn't physically go to the toilet. I couldn't move. Like, I had to pee in a pint glass in the room because I couldn't...
Because you couldn't move.
I couldn't sit up by myself. Nikki, my girlfriend, had to literally like, would have to like hoist me up.
Oh my God.
I'd lay in bed, not being able to move, like just in agony. I'd have to have two people help me go to the toilet. You know, I was like beyond broken. And I got tonsillitis because of inhaling so much water. My tongue was falling to pieces, like you probably saw with us as well, but to an even more extreme level, because he was doing 6 hours on, 6 hours off. I was in the water three times longer than that.
Yeah.
And it was, so my tongue was like, after 18 hours, was literally just like peeling off.
Have you seen any long-term effects from that swim?
For I did for a bit, but nothing too crazy. I'm quite surprised. You know, I lost 2 kilos literally in like 2 days after from the swim.
And, yeah.
Yeah, bed bound, couldn't eat anything. But somehow 5 or 6 days maybe after that, you know, in the little Airbnb, managed to get on the bike and begin the journey.
Wow.
And, I knew it would be tough the first few weeks, but I was just, although I was absolutely buggered, I just wanted to get to get started because it was such a big road ahead.
There was so much to come.
So much.
And once you sat, on that bike, what was the plan? Did you have to hit certain amounts of kilometers per day?
I mean,
did you have a certain route in mind?
It was a race. You know, we had the route, the rough plan across Europe planned out. I knew roughly how many Ks I wanted to do a day. Obviously in my head, how much I would have to do to get to get there on time.
Yeah.
Always just want to push it a little bit more. Cause again, it was always just a case of the more we do, the more cushion, the more breathing space we allow ourselves for if and when we get hit by a car or chased by dogs or food poisoning in India, you know, all the stuff that might happen. So it was just, but yeah, the first week, it was really hard after coming off the back of that. Didn't do as many Ks as I thought I would, but I knew I'd make it up. Later down the line, once the body conditioned.
Did you calculate an exact amount that you needed to do at least to stay on track to meet that Everest window?
Had a minimum of 120K a day for like months and months and months on end. But then obviously by the time I got past Europe, it brought it up to 140, 150 averages a day, you know. Up to like 90 to 100 miles a day.
What was the route you planned? So you go started in France.
Yeah.
Then you go down to Germany or cross?
France, Belgium,
yep.
Netherlands. We were in Netherlands for 2 hours. France, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Slovakia, Serbia, Bulgaria, Turkey.
Wow. And then did you have to cross any bodies of water in that time as well?
No, not during.
So all mainland, you get to Turkey.
And it wasn't meant to be any bodies of water, but Iran turned off the visa because of the military background.
I remember this.
So then we had to go up north or south, and we were so glad we did. So we went south, which added a little bit more on, but 5 more countries, which was incredible.
Amazing.
It ended up being the best thing in the world. Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, the entire Arabic Peninsula, the entire Arabian Desert. It was incredible. Best people in the world, you know, in Iraq and these places. And it was just adventure of the lifetime.
When you're traveling through these countries, did you have any kind of really sketchy moments that you can recall?
Oh God, yeah, man. So many. Not really with people, just the bike being knocked off, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Me and Molly were in a car crash that it would have killed us. It would have killed me if I sat on the other side of the car, you know, for example, just literally got hit or got smashed, got T-boned at 80 to 100 K an hour by a car. On the way up, so I just finished the day. Money was over. We just finished the day in southern Turkey near the Syrian border. Just finished the day on the way back to, obviously, because we'd finish in the position, obviously, drop the pin. And when they were around, well, when Molly was there, we'd wild camp normally, but because we had some of the team there, we
got a hotel.
We literally would find like 20 minute drive, for example.
Yeah.
Go there, then we'd come back in the morning to the exact same spot, carry on the exact same spot. On the way back to the hotel, T-boned, smash, like, absolutely. The car was written off that hit us, but because we had this 1996 school bus from London, it was like triple axle, absolute monster. Although she ended up costing us a lot of money, she did save our life because she was old and just a beast of a car.
The back end of the vehicle.
Yeah,
oh
literally.
I mean,
so imagine we got smashed like side on, 80 T-boned, and the other car was written off. We then drove that car another 2,000 miles all the way to, it was fine.
Wait, you didn't really have any fixing done?
It was smashed. No, not any fixing got done. If you go on the Instagram, you'll see me sat there like that. Because the next morning, obviously I was back at the same spot. Continuing on. Just had a bit of whiplash.
My word.
It was fine.
Well,
because we got hit, for example, like, because we removed all the seats from the back of this minibus.
Yeah.
And it's actually when we were removing the seats in Serbia, that's where the gun was pointing at the stand. That was a different story. So we'd removed all these seats from the bus. So there was only two or three seats left in the minibus at the back where I was sat. And they were obviously to the left-hand side of the vehicle, if that makes sense.
Sure.
And we got hit from the right hand side of the vehicle. So if it had been seats on the right hand side of the vehicle, like I would have been dead, like almost.
So you mentioned that you got held at gunpoint in Serbia.
I wasn't there, luckily. They did. It wasn't even held. It was just a hilarious kind of side story. I was cycling along and I get a call from Stan and that saying, Marius just like, who was with us for a while, just got held up at gunpoint or had a gun pointed at him. I was like, what are you on about? So they were trying to get rid of these seats in this minibus that we got driven over, and went to this scrapyard in Serbia, and the guys didn't speak any English, and they were just trying to say, can you take the seats for us? Can we, you know, help us take them out and leave them here? And they were like, yeah. But they were like so nice. They were trying to pay the guys for taking the seats rather than just like, you know,
just giving
but
them.
But they were like, no, don't worry. Just please take them. Like, we just need to get rid of them. And they were like, no, take it. And then they pulled out a Magnum, and it was a real fully loaded Magnum.
There's
footage of it, of literally a video of Stan, obviously being Stan filmed it.
So they were trying to give you money
yeah.
And they held you up at gunpoint. Because
that's the wrong word, but yeah. But once Stan and Marius had refused to take the money, they then got the gun out and were like, take the money.
It's a reverse robbery.
It was just a reverse robbery. It was a great laugh. So it was not held up at a gunpoint. It was just a great laugh.
They were imagine that. You just like, and someone's offering you money and they're threatening you to take it.
Yeah, the video is all on the Instagram and Facebook and YouTube.
But that's so funny because it's almost laughable in the situation, but you can't laugh because someone's literally got a gun.
Yeah, they were laughing just after it happened.
But
it was funny. I just kind of, but I wasn't there. I just laughed later on at the footage.
Yeah. How did you navigate going through countries where there was political tensions and stuff? Because you mentioned about the visa getting rejected.
Well, I mean, that was one reason why we were kind of relieved you weren't going through Iran, because it was just a little bit dangerous for American British citizens, and the people are incredible. Like, I've got loads of Iranian friends. The landscape, the culture is just beautiful. Iraq, for example, Iraq was amazing. Obviously, 10 years ago, different story. You know, we were going through these places with friends we met, who 10 years ago were literally hiding from ISIS, and and I was just cycling through places that were completely under ISIS control 10 years ago, and it was quite interesting, really interesting, you know what I mean? But I never felt unsafe, genuinely, anywhere, especially northern Iraq. Kurdistan is incredible.
I feel like areas like that are so hard to really know what the magnitude of them are like until you visit them.
Yeah, no,
because I feel like we in the West are so closed off to a lot of the news. Obviously, if you consume news, you know, Al Jazeera, all these sorts of things, you'll understand the situation a lot more.
Yeah.
But we're very much filtered what we hear.
We are filtered, and also we hear some things, and we just have a preconception in our head. You know, someone mentions Iraq, and you think war or a terrorist or something like that. It's just because unfortunately, that's the way we think, and it's just so stupid. So,
well, so the only time we see it on the media is when we
negative,
see a war zone.
As with media in general, everyone focuses on negative stuff.
Yeah,
no one really likes to shine the light on positive stuff. And
sure,
the people there are the most amazing people in the entire world.
Well, same with apparently Syria is one of the most beautiful
anywhere
countries.
In the Middle East, anywhere in anywhere in that area, the Arabic world and the Middle East is by far, like, overall compared to the UK.
Yeah.
Thousand times more friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Thousand times more friendly.
Everyone's very proud, and they're very happy with their country, and they want other people to experience.
They
love.
I feel so sorry for them, because obviously, 99.99999% are incredible people, so they're just trying to, you know, show the world how amazing their countries are. So it's it was great to play a little part, our little part in showing the world like how beautiful these places really are, you know, and how the friendliest people we met by far were from these places.
So the 12,000-kilometer cycle across Europe and Asia.
Yeah.
Would you, looking back, say this was the plain sailing part of the expedition?
Yes and no. I'd say from a physical part, even though I was still cycling 9, 10 hours a day, you know, leaving 8 o'clock in the morning, cycling until 5, 6 p.m. every day, it was steady. Because it was because I knew it would have to be, though, you know, to not break my body.
And
because it was always like, you know, it was always like, we had this talks about this at the start, am I going far enough each day?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Even from a perception, from the way that public would perceive me going not very far, but it was all about balancing that, going far but not too far, you know, because the whole question was, which I didn't even know, how far is enough where you're pushing yourself, but at the same time, it's a ultra marathon. It's not a sprint. Mm-hmm. From day one, it was, I need to get to Everest in the state to climb it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So I was told to not, you know, so at the end of the day, I would be absolutely, you know, shattered. Don't get me wrong, but I couldn't finish at a point I was broken. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I had to get up and repeat. You know, I'd do 5 days in a row, roughly 800-900K nonstop. And then I'd have 24 hours just to stretch, one day to stretch and recover. Mm-hmm. And then back to another 900 wow. nonstop. Wow. So it was maintenance. Mm-hmm. How do you maintain this? You know, of course I could have done I've done a couple of 220K days, big days. I could have done 250, 300 if somebody was like, do it. Of course I could have done, but that's not the point. It was, I need to get to Everest in a state where I'm not going to die.
So in terms of like sort of treachery, I guess, on the journey, it sounds to me like you avoided any huge, apart from the car crash, you avoided any really, really hairy moments.
But only by pure luck. Like honestly, like chased by hundreds of dogs on the Syrian-Iraq border with Turkey, a gigantic dog, like was this close from latching onto me, and I swerved into an oncoming lorry, which only just missed me. Coming into Baghdad, you know, like when you clip a bit of gravel on your bike and you have to save it. Come into Baghdad, that happened and there was oncoming traffic because of roadworks, and they don't care over there. And I'm not even joking. I saved myself, and that one moment, the lorry was like came past no more than 1 foot past me. If I had not saved it, there's no doubt in my mind I wouldn't be here, sat here right now. No doubt.
Wow.
And that was just Iraq. And then there's so many more of them moments that happened through the whole of the rest of the Middle East was okay. But then Karachi, Pakistan, Lahore, Delhi, India. It was just insane. Like, I got so good at dodging tuk-tuks and cows. It was becoming a superpower.
The cows are just everywhere, aren't they?
It's just, you're being like a three lane motorway, and like just they're just like laying in the middle of the
and
motorway.
They don't do anything because
they're gods. They're sacred. Yeah, they're sacred. Like everyone just does not even like beeping. They just they're slow and they'll go around them.
God, and the cows being are just cow cows. In are just India,
like, yeah, look at me.
Yeah.
So many videos we've got where I'm like just playing chicken with a ball, like while cycling down the motorway. So funny.
Would you out of the countries that you travelled through, the kind of mainland Europe and Asia, mm-hmm. is there one that stands out to you?
In terms of like friendliness and hospitality and amazing people, Iraq.
Yeah.
And in terms of natural beauty, Oman, mm-hmm. by far beautiful, like incredible. In terms of food, like, and people combined, Pakistan. Mm-hmm. It's just mad.
Were you having to be really careful with what you ate in terms of what thinking about ahead in terms of like preparation? Because when you say you have a race and you have a big you know, physical sort of event coming up, you're always super careful about what you eat in the days leading up to it. So when it comes to race day, your stomach's fine and you're in the best optimal shape.
I couldn't think about that.
Yeah.
There was no set way. Obviously, we were dynamic. We were on the move every day for 200 days, the first 6 months, I couldn't tell you where we were sleeping the next day. Every day, we didn't know where we were sleeping, let alone where we were eating that day. It would be a case of literally eat where and when you can. And then I'd even like chuck mass gainers, you know, we'd be in the background, back streets of like Pakistan somewhere, and we would have found like this dodgy nutrition shop. So 1,000 calories and a mass gaining shake, boom.
Wow.
Just any way to get calories down you, just rice, you know, like it, just anything and everything. But I was, no matter what, I knew I'd always be in a deficit. I'd always be in a big deficit no matter what. But as with my other expeditions, like the Atlantic, like the US and stuff, I knew that if I just, you know, got enough weight on me, you know, and as long as it wasn't like stupid deficit, that I'd survive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And in the end, we did lose 3 stone, but that was better than what we expected, to be honest.
No, for sure. I mean, I think overall losing 3 stone isn't too bad. At least you didn't get any illness.
Not pure illness. I mean, I got food poisoning 3 times in India, which was to be expected. Day 2, that was annoying. Rice.
Can I just ask this genuine question?
Yeah.
This is me being so naive here. Mm. When people say about things like Delhi belly and food poisoning, what is it that's causing it?
It's, I mean, a combination of bad luck and just bad hygiene, like bad sanitation.
So it's the bad sanitation from where the food is you're buying it from.
Yeah, it's both. It's kind of a combination of both. I mean, we didn't get it once in Pakistan, but I think that was a lot of it was down to luck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it was just kind of, again, ironic that the day 2 in India is is when I got dysentery. Yeah. So it's just, yeah, like anything from like water source, you know, anything. But I got food poisoning the first time just from recooked rice in a nice hotel. Dysentery, which is one of the easiest ones.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even due to like bad, you know, it was just, I don't know, it was that because me and Stan ate the exact same thing, exact same room service. But the only thing different I had was I had rice as well because of the I just wanted more carbs, obviously.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was horrible. Day two, and I was so like, so we'd had delays before because of having to cross the Pakistan border, which is another story by itself. And yeah, I was just so determined. So I was up till 5 or 6 a.m. out both ends. It was mental. Managed to go back to sleep. I slept till 12. I still got 100K done that day, even though I was like,
that's incredible how you're doing that with food poisoning.
Yeah, but I was so lucky because at least the three times I had it only lasted 48 hours. You know what I mean? Some people get food poisoning that lasts 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. If I had one batch of food poisoning that lasted 2 weeks, mission over.
Mm. Were there any moments during this cycle where you almost packed it in?
No, not physically. Again, probably because of the life changing swim that I'd had.
Mm.
Like, and that just made me so like, nothing's going
to
stop me.
Grateful to be alive.
Grateful to be alive. And also just like, nothing's going to stop me. Nothing was as hard as that.
Yeah.
And I mean, the only thing that would stop me would be bureaucracy or a being killed by a car, you know, which again, nearly happened so many times. So that's why at the time I got to Everest, and day before Everest, Dan was like, you know, you could die tomorrow. By that point, I was so numb to it because of the amount of times we'd come so close to, you know, to death. The whole Northern India, Punjab, and the whole of Northern Pakistan, the whole province of Punjab in Northern Pakistan and India for a month, the thickest, densest fog you've ever seen in your life.
Wow.
I'm talking, you can't see 3 meters in front of you for the first 4 hours of the day. So from 8 to midday, nothing. And I had a crappy little red light on, and cycling along those roads, like Stan would just be shitting himself every single day. Like when I left,
God,
because
poor Stan.
But I couldn't wait until midday.
Yeah, I couldn't. By the way, yeah, let's add context here. Stan also was with Russ for Project Africa, so he traveled. Did he travel the whole way? Or
yeah,
Stan was there the whole time, and then you take him across the world again. So I think he's found his niche, hasn't he?
Yeah, you could say that.
So obviously, like, death was literally on your door the entire trip, essentially, whether it be stuff out of your control, or it be health related, or it be
physical.
It could be absolutely anything. But then also, you had the Everest hike at the end. Everest summit at the end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is probably one of the riskiest things a human being can do.
Yeah.
How do you kind of deal with that whole emotion of knowing that that's sort of around the corner?
It's just, like I say, we take the risk every day without knowing about it, crossing the road to go to work. And it's just, I think of it like that. It might be the ADHD or the way I've always thought, but life's just too short. And you've got to be willing to take the risks to get the rewards.
Yeah.
And it's just, death is a part of life. Mm-hmm. And you just have to, you know, linking that into it exactly, you know, it's kind of the theme of my dad's funeral when I done the eulogy, a favorite quote from my favorite film, every man dies but not every man really lives. So I'd rather die doing my dream, you know, than fail trying than getting to the end and having not done it.
That's amazing.
Know? Like, what is happiness? Is getting to your deathbed and someone asks you, like, even, you know, I tried it, even if I failed, what would you regret more, laying there at 90 knowing you hadn't tried it, or the fact you'd given it a go but you just couldn't do it?
Would you say happiness is that to you? Because everyone's got a different barometer of happiness, and I spoke about this on another podcast with Reeve, and we were saying about, like, for me, happiness and success are kind of embroiled in the same sort of wrapping paper for me,
in a way.
And success to me is finding happiness in my life where I have full control and freedom over my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is a good definition.
What would you say is happiness to you then?
Happiness for me is two things. One of them is, as I said, get into my deathbed when I'm 90, and we're going to have many regrets, but all it is, one of the two reasons, definitions for me, is get into my deathbed at 90, having had as few regrets in my life as I could have done, and being true to myself. The other definition of happiness is to me, is one of the reasons why I do these expeditions, is like getting yourself so uncomfortable and pushing yourself out there so that when you come back to Earth, to reality, you see the magic in the tiny, tiny little things. You see the magic in a cup of tea, in a hot shower, a pint at the pub, laying on the grass.
I bet, man.
And for me, happiness is being able to go out and make yourself uncomfortable and then coming back and having that perspective. Happiness is being able to see the magic in the little things. Mm. If you can see, if a cup of tea or a smile from someone who you haven't seen in a long time or a hot shower can genuinely bring you happiness, I think that's true.
Do you
happiness.
Think we're, our minds are a bit warped now in like society where
that's what I mean.
We don't know how to access that layer of happiness because we're constantly being hit with these dopamine rushes of whether it be from drugs, alcohol, social media,
a mixture of that and social media and society just telling you what's normal and everyone being shoved in this little bubble that you're told is normal, sat at home and you were heating with your heating on, comfy as hell, never pushing yourself. Humans mentally, physically, physiologically, emotionally, we're meant to be pushed. You're meant to they're not, the human body, human condition doesn't grow or thrive being comfortable. You know what I mean? You'll stay where you are. If you want to just plateau for the rest of your life, go for it. But if you want to actually grow, you need to actually push yourself a little bit further. And it's not got to be doing crazy stuff. That's not why I've done it. One of the chapters in my book is proportionality. Mm-hmm. Your 5K walk or that hill is as important as the next person's ultra marathon. Equally as amazing. And it's just about doing your Everest, no matter how small it is. And then, you know, go for a swim you haven't before, go for a cold dip, for example, you know, go for camping if you've always wanted, thought about it, but you've been a bit scared, do that. When you get back home the next day from camping, your bed's going to feel amazing.
It's going to feel amazing.
Better than it did the day before.
It's interesting though, because stories like yours and achievements like yours are so important to the way people move and live their lives. I don't know whether it's just recency bias for me, but I look at what we are seeing now with people doing these amazing things in the world, like yourself, someone like Russ running bottom to top of Africa, you know, all of these incredible feats of human endeavor. We're now seeing again, okay, for a while, obviously, people like Edmund Hillary, all of that. So he's vastly like sort of, you know, incredible explorers that would do the things for that era, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Now we're seeing,
but then
more
it was
people.
Exploration now,
exactly,
now it's for more deeper reasons and personal
pushing
reasons
themselves out there. Do you think we're going to get to a point now where more and more people are feeling inspired to do things that it's going to improve society on the whole?
I hope so. I think so, yeah. And I think if enough people do it, you know, and use the power of like media and social media to actually to do good with it, which is what it's there for, then I think, you know, an actual difference can be made. But you know, all I can do, all we can do is just push out that message and positivity as much as can physically be possible, as much as it can be done.
Yeah, before we get onto the Everest stuff, you did obviously sign up this challenge with a purpose, a charity endeavor in mind. Talk to me about that, because it's a pretty incredible cause that you were doing it for.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you know, the cause, the charity is amazing, you know, and it's, well, yeah, I'll go on to the charity first. So yes, Avsim, they're a small charity based here in London, small non-profit organisation, only been running for 4 years, but they've literally made a mental health course using wildlife and nature to treat PTSD, and not just PTSD, other conditions, not just military, police, people that are struggling. So they'll take 6 to 8 people, you know, at the moment just twice a year, but hopefully we can get more courses, and they'll take them to the zoo, for example, and use animals to treat that. But also, literally on par with that, they send these people to like Africa, places like Africa, use the skills they've got that they had from all their time in the military to train anti-poaching units, to train like, you know, anything from tracking to wildlife crime to first aid, all these skills, using them in that way as well. So for me, linking my biggest passions, because I say I worked in zoos, I worked with animals, and I worked in zoology before joining the military when I was younger.
Wow.
So that was before, that was literally from like 18 to 20. And I studied it, and it was my passion, you know, to do that. So to find someone who linked mental health, veteran, and wildlife into one was really good.
PTSD in the military.
Yeah.
Have you had much experience in dealing with that?
I've had a bit of experience in dealing with it, looking at other people, but I've been lucky enough. I was lucky enough to join, like, not have to see it myself. You know, I joined just after Afghan, so I never had to, unfortunately, see my friends go through that or my friends get shot. You know, I was quite lucky, but I'm very close friends, like best friends, with people who have literally been blown out of tanks, have seen their best friends die in front of their own eyes. So I've seen firsthand the effects that it has.
Conversations you've had with people that have experienced that, what's the kind of most common theme of to what they say is dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder with that?
It's different for every person. The worrying part is for a lot of people, it's just going into that, going into themselves, and they just won't talk to you for ages. And,
yeah.
That's kind of one of the recurring themes, you know, is shutting themselves off, which is one of the big things we're trying to tackle, you know, all mm-hmm. the time, you know. One of the things for me that I want to do now is, from having finished this and having a little bit of a platform to do something, I'm going to start my own foundation. So
amazing.
Creating a mental health and creating an adventure and mental health retreat. For anyone that wants it.
America, the American military had a big, well, not a big issue with it, but it seemed to be far more prevalent in American forces and ex-forces, the kind of lack of help.
Yeah, there's just a big lack of support and understanding for it. Luckily now there's a little more understanding, and there's a heck of a lot of awesome organizations out there.
Yeah.
There's so many places you can get support now. Like
there
compared to 10, 20 years ago.
There was the awful... tragic incident with the American sniper.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's just one example. Yeah.
So for those who don't know, American Sniper obviously is a movie as well, but it's about, do they say he was the most successful, but in their eyes, successful sniper in US military history?
Yeah, I think he had the most confirmed kills as a sniper, basically. Chris did, yeah. And that story is just
insane.
Just go shows you what happened. Yeah, shows you how obvious it is and how deadly it can be, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously it's on a big, much bigger scale over there, but yeah, the fact that, yeah, he'd gone through all that and then he was just teaching back home in his backyard.
Teaching someone at a shooting
range. Teaching
veterans,
teaching fellow veterans, and then boom, something something in his head just went and he ended up basically blue on blue.
Yeah.
Basically just ended up getting killed by his own. Which is crazy.
Insane. They're honestly, such a sad story.
Yeah, so sad.
But it's amazing that your efforts and your journey was towards something that's such a, you know, means so much to you.
Yeah.
And means so much to other veterans.
Yeah, no, it was, mate. But I mean, I think it's important to also say, you know, that anyone that says, you know, I'm doing this for the charity, for this person. That is true, but that's just a bonus. And like anyone that says it's only for that, I'm not doing it for me, it's total bollocks.
Yeah.
The reason you do something, and it's fine. That's how it should be. The reason you do something, whether it's going for a walk, your 5K run, or an ultra marathon, you're doing it for you, first and foremost, mm-hmm. for yourself, for your own growth, for your own reasons, you know, which is, you know, for me, it was that pure kind of see how far I can push myself and then all these stuff is amazing bonuses, which mean the world to me. You know, the last chapter of the book is like purpose beyond self, diving into the reasons why you do things more than just for you.
Yeah.
And it's many reasons.
So you get to Nepal.
Yes.
After running 9 kilometers.
Favorite country in the world.
Yeah. Did you love it?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and Stan have been in Africa 54 days by this point, 3 times food poisoning, nothing against India, obviously, but I was so happy to get to that border after, I think it was 740K of running through India after just finishing the 12,000 bike ride. So it was relief just to have a different scenery, if that makes sense, different culture, just different something, different food as well. You know, I do like food, but 54 days of curry did start to get to me.
Yeah.
And so the food and the people and the landscape, because it was completely flat the whole run, basically, bar a little bit. And as soon as, like, day two of crossing into Nepal, it was like, within like 3 days, it was like 5 Snowdons.
Wow.
Of like, just to get to the Kathmandu Valley, of going up and down, up and down, up and down. And it was amazing. Beautiful, like beautiful, but tough. The last couple of days was tough.
And then you have a 360 kilometer trek to Everest Base Camp.
Yeah, that was it. But that was beautiful though. So the most kind of, the best unplanned thing that happened in this whole journey was, like, my, you know, heroes, like Tenzing and Hillary, Em and Hillary and Tenzing. We didn't know this, but back in 1953, when they'd done it, there was no hotels in Kathmandu or anything. So they'd slept in the British embassy and had breakfast with the British ambassador before leaving on foot, obviously, because there was no roads or airplanes before leaving on foot. So when I finished the 874K run to Kathmandu, the deputy British ambassador was one of the people meeting, and we had like a little celebration and all that.
Oh, amazing. And so kind of, you sort of towed the same path as Ed.
Well, yeah, because then it led on to a conversation, and then boom. Nikki and my partner came over, and the day before, I stayed I slept at the British Embassy in the VIP suite, woke up in the morning, had breakfast with the British ambassador, got given the flag, ate the same, what we thought may have been as close as they could tell, the same breakfast as what Hillary and Tenzing had had.
Wow.
So we literally replicated the first climb of Everest in history with the longest climb of Everest in history.
That is incredible.
Following in literally in the footsteps of Hill. So like,
did actually you sleep in the same room?
Well, no, it wasn't in the same room because the embassy was like across the road, kind of, if this makes back then. Mm-hmm. Long story, but yeah, it wasn't the exact same room.
They changed
room.
Buildings.
Yeah, it wasn't the exact same room, but it was the same, like, it was as
that's incredible.
As exactly as it was in terms of staying at the embassy with the ambassador in the morning, replicating the breakfast they had, even to the down to the last thing that happened was they were handed the flag. The British ambassador handed them the flag before they set off on foot to Mount Everest, and we'd done the exact same thing following the same route, and it was just mad. It was to actually do that for me, you know, having these guys being like my idols for such a long time, was just so special.
That is so cool. And obviously when you begin the trek to base camp, what's going through your mind? Because climbing Everest, as we mentioned earlier, is one of the most dangerous things a human being can do.
Yeah.
Not only is it dangerous, but it also costs so much money.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
So this expedition, I imagine, wasn't cheap in itself.
No, absolutely.
For people watching and they've seen people summit Everest.
Yes,
It's always been thought as quite an elitist thing.
That's it. Yeah. And we've even had comments about that, which, you know, the only kind of negative comments we've got are people just assuming, I know loads of people that could do it, but he can only do it because mummy and daddy's money and all this. Honestly, it's hilarious. Obviously, they were shut down.
Very served your country.
But. Well, not even that. Like, obviously, as soon as I explain that, you know, I have no money, my dad died, I look after my mom, they soon shut up.
Yeah. So,
because the whole message was, and it still is, you know, even though it might be expensive, it might be hard, nothing is out of your reach.
No.
You're in control if possible.
No.
Simple as that. So yeah, sorry, going back to your question, right?
So obviously it's an incredibly expensive part.
To this point,
and it was, what's the expedition costing you up until the Everest?
I mean, you can't even put a number on it, 100 grand or something.
Yeah, and then climbing
Everest. Pure costs, as in pure costs. That's not including a lot of, probably 200 grand.
Say 200 grand up to this point, and then climbing Everest, I could be wrong here, but it usually costs about £100,000, doesn't it, per person?
Not quite. It's normally about 40
to 50.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
So it's these numbers I'm seeing online are quite inflated then.
Oh, massively, yeah. Like, you'll get a decent Everest expedition now. It goes up, actually, this coming year, it goes up $15,000.
And that is to pay the Sherpas more, isn't it?
No, that's just a tax for the government.
Oh
yeah,
okay.
That's just because the governments have decided to put another $15,000.
They know people will do it
because if anyone's climbing Everest, $15,000 for them. For most people, obviously, for me, it's massive, and for us, it wouldn't have been massive. But for a lot of, not for everyone, of course. But of course, a lot of people that climb high altitude mountaineering is I'm not gonna say it's a rich person sport, but overall, it is. You know, it is like not rich persons, but you have to have money.
You have to
do high. You have to go behind to do high, exit, you know, unless you grind like we did to get there. So, but it is hard, So, that
was a bit tough. How did you go about choosing your team, your Sherpas?
It was, about halfway through the expedition, I think I was in Iraq before we even knew who we were climbing Everest with. We made a decision in the Middle East. I got reached out by two legends. So a mutual sponsor of ours, actually, by coincidence. So the youngest woman to climb the 14 peaks, 22 years old, climbing all the 14 highest mountains in the world.
Wow.
Adriana Brownlee, and then Gelgi Sherpa. Gelgi's again, 39, 8,000 meter peaks, 10 Everests. You ever seen the video of that guy who strapped a guy to his back on Everest and walked him down? That was him. That was him.
Wow.
So these guys got hold of me, and I just had a good vibe straight away. The team, Molly, Stan, had a great vibe, and we just knew we'd be like family.
Uh-huh.
I knew we'd be really good, and more importantly, my life. It was up to me for who did I want to have my life in the hands of.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I knew we'd be good. So I just literally became like brothers, you know what I mean? And like, to the point, I mean, unfortunately he's not here because his visa is taking a bit while to get to come through this time. But he was meant to be coming to mine in Devon and staying for like the whole week.
Oh man, that's so nice.
But it's just annoying. It's so annoying he's not here, bless him. But
absolute
legend. So I ended up climbing with these guys, and that was the plan from then on. They're amazing. Yeah. And new, kind of like a new company, but so professional. And they're the only reason why we got up so early. So the only reason why, after all that, 500 people climbing, I was the first person to climb Everest and get down.
Wow, that's incredible.
The entire season.
You were the first person to
not down to me.
Ascend and descend.
Yeah, yeah. She hadn't climbed ever. There was a couple of people who on the same day as me who, you know, got up. But it was just the day after they finished the lines and all that. The very first like day that it was possible to climb, yeah. But a few people had come down and had to be evacuated from Camp 2 and Camp 1. Because you haven't actually, you know, in my mind as well, but also officially, because you don't actually get officially recognised until you've got back to base camp. You've not climbed Everest until you're back to base camp, because the most dangerous part is the Kimbu Icefall between Camp 1 and base camp. Yep. You know, like any mountain, you know, you can't just climb to the summit and then get a helicopter off.
So explain me the logistics. So you're climbing it with two other people, two people who are kind of leading you up.
Yep.
Did you have anyone else join you going up?
No, not the Everest part.
Just
not
three
at all.
Of you going up.
So Everest base camp to, no, so the Everest base camp trek to Everest base camp. We had an amazing team of like 20 people who joined us. So yeah, I put the message out. I think I had like 17 strangers who I'd never met.
That's so cool.
Just from putting the message out on Instagram. Amazing. Came to meet us to do the base camp trek with us, mm-hmm. to be part of the journey. And it was incredible. But and from base camp to the summit, just me, Galji, and it was going to be just us. But then his nephew, who's only a couple of years London younger than him, absolute, again, legend. I love him so much. Kopudi. So he just came as well, because he's now qualified to guide on Everest as well, which is really good.
Wow.
So we were just like a great trio together. Yeah. Us three. It was great. Yeah.
And so when you're planning your ascend,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah.
You have base camp.
Yeah.
And then what are the other stages to it, and how long would it take from start to finish?
I mean, it's like 3 weeks process from doing, because you have to go from base camp, normally up to like camp 3 and back down again.
Okay.
Like a rotation to get acclimatized. We climbed a mountain beforehand, Lubuche East with Stan as well, 6,100 meters. So we climbed a mountain, a different mountain, which was the same height as Camp 1 on Everest, because that meant by doing that, you don't have to cross the deadly glacier, the deadly Kumbu Icefall, which is between base camp and Camp 1. That's the most dangerous part. You know, crossing that, that's the one with the ladders and crevasses, 200 feet down. The less times you cross that, the better. So we kind of acclimatized just as efficiently by not crossing it, by going to climb a different mountain as well. Not only that, you get to climb another mountain as well. Mm-hmm. So we did that and then I went across, had to cross it, went all the way up to nearly Camp 3, all the way back down to base camp, and then back up to the summit. That whole process takes like 3 weeks.
Wow.
But the actual summit push, so when you go for it, it's like 3 days.
Okay.
So you go from Camp 1, you go from base camp the second on the summit push, you cross the ice fall all the way to Camp 2 in one day. So you leave at like midnight, and then you get to say Camp 2 that like 12, 13 hours later, you know what I mean? And then you stay at Camp 2.
You sleep in tents.
You sleep at Camp 2. Next day, up to Camp 3. And that's when it's really hard. You get like a few hours sleep there like we did. So up to Camp 3. And then you leave quite early from Camp 3, like 9, 10 hour day to Camp 4. And then, which is really hard push, like up the Lhotse face like that.
Wow.
9, 10 hour day, and then you get to Camp 4 in the death zone. Then we only had 3 hours rest, not sleeping, just 3 hours to like get some food in, lay down, and then it was 11 hour summit push to get to the summit, and then it was 3 hours back to Camp 4,
the death zone,
back down to Camp 4. Yes, Camp 4 and above is the death zone.
So obviously, apart from the obvious,
yeah,
why is it called the death zone?
Because above that height, Camp 4 towards the top, that's where the oxygen is so low that if something happens to you, there's no the helicopters can't go that high.
Yeah.
The only way you could get down is if you were rescued by someone, which is very unlikely unless you have a legend like Galji.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's why it is. That's why, you know, I had to step over two corpses looking up at me, you know, mask on, crampons on, just laying out there towards the summit.
I was going to ask you this because I've seen recently a few videos of people climbing Everest, getting to the top, and I see these videos of people filming dead bodies on the mountain.
Yeah, no, that's horrible. Yeah, I would never film it.
It feels so wrong.
It's so wrong, man. Like, even looking at it, you almost feel like you want to
look away.
You know, like you have to, unfortunately, not step over them, but it's like around, you know, you have to obviously, they've been there for years.
And why have they been there for years?
Because that's where they've passed away, and
they can't bring them back down.
Yeah, I mean, you sometimes you can, but what if someone's died up there? You're risking your life, like the Sherpas, you know, you are risking your life phenomenally to like try and bring them down.
Yeah,
that's why it's a death zone, you know, because there's so little oxygen up there.
Didn't Spencer Matthews go to try and find his brother and bring his brother's body down?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he went back to base camp, and I mean, crazy story. Obviously, they were trying. I don't know how to say the exact details of the story, but yeah, I mean, there was a team. I think there was just a team, wasn't there? Who the plan was to go up and try and find a body. There's so many up there though, and every year it changes, like the snow cover, you know, every year new bodies get uncovered.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy. Like there's a map. Wow. There's a map of like I saw, you know, of like Evie's got a little red dot of where all the bodies on Everest are. And yeah, it was crazy. So it was really sombering though, you know, the most incredible feeling in the world coming up there, but then having to go around these bodies, and then it just reminds you, you're only halfway. The summit is only halfway. And yeah. I promised my family and friends I'd get home alive. And so that was kind of mixed emotions.
There's one in particular that's passed away recently, a climber called Philippe Santiago. Have you seen about this?
That's not the Malaysian.
He's the Filipino guy.
The Filipino guy, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so
he was the first one to die this year.
He was the first person to pass away this year on the mountain.
Yeah.
And people were filming his body. Now, it went quite viral because it was like, this is so disrespectful to him and his family that you're just filming his body. And a lot of the time, the videos that I see, particularly on social media, they're doing it for like engagement bait.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and they're doing it, you know, they have it at the start of the video. It's usually some like really like dark music in the background. They're filming all the bodies. It just feels horrible to watch. It almost feels like people are creating Mount Everest as a, like a dark tourism hotspot.
No, it's just, it's ridiculous.
And Philippe Santiago, as you said, was the first person to pass away this year. Whilst you were climbing and whilst you were going through your expedition, was there anyone near to you that passed?
Not within my immediate kind of, that's one of the things I was worried about, you know, is obviously something happens up there and me and Goji would have helped them, you know. So that's why we were very thankful and very lucky to be up there with like probably less than 5% of people that have ever climbed Everest have like a clear Hillary step, have no cues, that just you in the mountain. It's so
did
beautiful.
You have that?
Yeah. Yeah, it was like,
you see all the cues and
yeah,
stuff.
No
it's
cues,
insane.
No cues. Like for me, like I often sometimes think like that the swim that we had, you know, I remember, I kind of half think, you know, Dad was really looking out for us because the Everest part, we maybe got a bit of karma, good karma coming our way for that. And I was just so thankful though, for the fact that the dream was achieved in that way, not only being the first, but having a clear summit was just, I could have never have dreamed that that could have been the case, but no, luckily for us, I never saw anybody physically around me. Don't get me wrong. I mean, mate, at Camp 2, there's always people being evacuated by helicopter, like who are close to death, you know, around you, but you don't see exactly who they are. You hear after someone from this company has got pulmonary edema, you know, has got high altitude pulmonary edema and all this, and it's scary, you know, all sorts. But I was very lucky, fortunate to have, because there was no one up there, you know, I didn't see any of these bodies laying there at Camp 4 or on the summit. I didn't have to, apart from people that had been there for years, obviously. But
for sure. I'm going to ask something now that I mean this in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
No, and when you're climbing Everest with two people that have done it so many times before,
yeah,
what's the kind of mental weight for you when you're taking two people up? These people are dedicating their life again,
absolutely,
to take you up a mountain for the first time.
Yeah.
How does that sit with you in terms of, did you feel like some added pressure to it because of that?
I mean, I always had a pressure. It's Sherpas, they're just the backbone of the whole nation, the most incredible people. And it's just all based, Everest should be and always has been, it's just all based on mutual respect.
Yeah.
And you know, you go up there, you know, it's their livelihood.
Yeah.
And trust me, they love it. Even the porters, people try and give you, you know, give people a jip for like carrying their bags up, for example. Like I've spoken to hundreds of porters, you know, Gilgi used to be one. Every Sherpa used to be a porter.
And they love it. Their job is
the one that carries the bag, ones that carry the bags up, you know, for example.
So they're climbing Everest themselves and they're doing this multiple times a season.
Well, but I mean, they'll probably only climb on average once a season. Yeah.
Okay.
But they love it. Their job and they absolutely adore it. And as long as obviously it's the person's responsibility to make sure who they go with pays them fairly. Mm-hmm. Like the AGA who we climb with, amazing. It's Nepalese owned. It's Nepalese ran.
Amazing.
You know, it's incredible. Everyone there is family and it's incredible. And they love it. So for me, the only, I say again, it's just mutual respect.
Yeah.
And it's just the idiots that like ignore the advice from their Sherpas, that's when it gets just stupid, you know, like, because that's why people die and that's why Sherpas die, because people don't know when to turn around, when to say no. You know, if your Sherpa tells you you're climbing with someone who is the expert, if they tell you you've got half an hour, 50 meters to go until the summit, if they tell you if we don't turn around now your oxygen's going to run out and you might die, if you don't turn around at that moment, it's on you. Yeah. But I think anyone, you know, I think if anyone does that, the Sherpa then should just come back. Yeah. That's their decision. Because the second you do that, you're putting their lives at risk. Mm-hmm. And I was worried about that, obviously, in one respect. After this massive expedition, am I kind of being, am I being disrespectful here? Or am I being selfish, putting these guys' lives at risk? Mm-hmm. You know, climbing it in a state of being. So I wouldn't have climbed it unless I truly felt that I was strong enough to do it. So I would never put their lives at risk just for vanity, you know what I mean? Because it's never been about that, genuinely. Like, never was for me. And I know people would like to say easier said than done, but it's true. So we all felt great as a team. And yeah, it was just amazing.
One of the most harrowing sights on the mountain is something that's been known now as Green Boots. Now, Green Boots is one of the most famous, quote unquote, I say famous, it feels like a wrong terminology to use it, but it's the most, one of the most famous bodies left out on Everest. What's the story behind this?
Now, honestly, someone mentioned it when I was there, but I'd never even heard of Green Boots before. So you probably know even more than me, to be honest. So
did you see it on your climb?
No,
okay.
No.
All right.
No, the only ones I saw, as I say, were the two within the last, on the end of the Hillary Step, the last 45 minutes before the summit. I was thankful not anymore, but obviously it was still a bit of a shock when you think someone's a rock and it's actually a body.
Yeah. That's incredible that you say each year they discover new bodies because of the snowfall.
Yeah, I mean, because you think the ice, the glacier as well, for example, is always changing. It's moving every day. It's a moving ice sheet. So, you know, things are getting things are reappearing all the time. And, you know, it's crazy how it works. You know, you might get a body that's been there for, or an item that's been there for years, half a century maybe.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's crazy. It's a moving environment.
Yeah. So obviously you get back down to base camp in one piece. The challenge is over. You've done it.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that feeling.
Got down to the bottom. We had a beer and we walked. Then we walked together back. And when we got to that, when I saw the tents for the first time, I just broke down like into tears, man. It was just crazy knowing that that point, finally, we'd done it. We were back from the Crossy Icefall. We were safe. And again, I'm still hasn't sank in. It didn't sink in then. You know what I mean? It didn't sink in. I walked into the kind of community tent where everyone else was. There was a lot of anticipation, because obviously they all knew I was going. No one else was going. So everyone was kind of like, amazing. The whole community there was really nice. You know, everyone was supportive.
Special.
So I walked into that tent, like just dropped to my knees and everyone just hugged me. And it was like just the best moment. The best moment of my life, man. Like, it was just, yeah, the relief that we'd just done it. I still think I'm going to wake up like some bloody forest in Turkey daydreaming, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And this was all just a big daydream, but.
Oh, mate. But it must have been like the overwhelming relief that you survived versus the achievement.
Yeah.
How are you balancing those two emotions?
I don't know. I still don't know. I mean, I'm just, the next 6 months is just going to be trying to figure out emotions and how to come back down to earth. I haven't had to come down yet and I'm hoping I'll be okay. But it's fine because there's so much more to come. And like, as I've always said from the start, you know, the future is what you make it. The life is what you make it. So now we're just going to do as much good as we can.
What's your biggest takeaway from this whole expedition?
Or biggest one takeaway? Just reinforcing the fact that you're the only person that knows the definition of possible is yourself. The only person that knows the definition is looking in the mirror. That's the biggest takeaway is that we've proved that you haven't got to be superhuman or super athlete, you know, or like some polished whatever to achieve these things. You just need to take that first uncomfortable step. That's what it's reinforced mainly.
Amazing, man. Look, it's absolutely incredible what you've achieved.
Thanks, bro.
You obviously have done it with such a incredible mindset in terms of what you wanted to lay out. You're doing it for charity. What's the one bit of legacy that you want to leave from doing this?
The one bit of legacy, as I say, is just to, for me, halfway through it was like getting the most best thing I found about this was having these messages from these young teenagers and boys, men and women, saying how much like I'm the reason they've gone to the gym now. I'm the reason they've signed up for their first this. The reason they've gone for a walk. So if I can leave anything from this, it's pretty much echoing what I just said, that people can take away that they are totally in control. And the main lesson is to not listen to a single thing anyone tells you what you can and can't do. You know what I mean? Like when the doctors told me I wouldn't be able to play tennis again, let alone do the longest climb of Everest in history. Yeah. Just make your own possible, mate. That's the main legacy that we hope to get out there. And I just hope to continue pushing that message out.
Incredible, man. It's so nice now, obviously, as I said, like so many people doing these incredible challenges that's birthing, maybe it's the tiniest little bit of spark in someone's head. Like I get messages from lads that go, I watch your YouTube video and I now want to sign up for a half marathon.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
And
that's everything.
Is the whole reason everyone listening and watching this is probably so bored of me saying this, net positive. Like you're doing something that you're achieving and you're doing, putting yourself into such uncomfortable position to better yourselves as a human being. Also, you're achieving something which you will be able to tell your grandkids.
No, exactly.
And then you're also in turn putting out content that's going to inspire a generation and inspire a lot of other people.
That became such a superpower. That became such an added bonus, which I never thought would happen. Obviously, at first I thought that would be like added pressure.
Yeah.
The world of expectations on your shoulders, but no. Having these people message you saying like, I've signed up for my first triathlon.
Incredible.
And all this, that, and you have a bike, especially young people, like dozens a day, kids, it's incredible. Yeah. And right now my main mission is just to amplify that to another level as much as possible.
I hate to be that guy, man, but what's next?
That's all right. Everyone finishes it, right, don't they?
Yeah. Obviously, I didn't want to be that cliche.
Apart from continuing to demolish as many roast dinners as I can.
Yeah. Well, okay. Actually, let's talk about that real quick. Yeah. When you left Everest Base Camp after completing, what was the first thing you craved? I needed to get my hands on something.
Hot shower.
Okay.
Yeah. But in terms of food.
When you're flying back to the UK and you thought about what you could have.
Well, but then and there, it was just like good solid food. So I had a chicken burger back at Lukla. What was I craving mostly? A proper coffee was definitely top of the list, even though there was quite a good coffee there. Probably some, sorry to all the vegetarians out there, but some good meat.
Nice,
you know what I mean? After all that, you know, it was like,
that's always the first thing I crave, you know?
Yeah, man. And, but I just wanted to get, but in terms of getting home, just pub food, man. Pub food and my golden retriever. That was it. That's all I was looking out for. And and tons of roast dinners. And obviously my mum and my girlfriend.
Your girlfriend was with you for a while on the journey.
Nikki's been amazing. From the whole start, unbelievable. Came to Turkey and then came to Kathmandu. Mm. It's been a mixture of such. A few people making it happen, massive, without Molly and Stan, sat in a pub. This is nearly exactly a year ago, just thinking, this mad bastard, we're going to...
I remember when Molly first told me about this, I was thinking... Yeah.
Oh, really?
I remember her, like, I can't remember where we were. Was it when we were in Ireland?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were in Galway having a beer.
Oh, nice.
And we were just chatting about it. I was like, this sounds absolutely fucking insane.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't sound doable, but the idea of someone doing a triathlon across the world sounds so cool.
Yeah.
And I always looked at it. I watched your videos and I saw what you guys were putting out. And one of my frustrations, and I'll be really honest with you here, was how more people didn't know about it. And that for me was like,
I'm sure Molly shared that as well.
And it was just like, there were so many people doing things in the world that were like, incredible, and everything's relative. And you've, as you said, everyone's got their own Everest.
But obviously, of course, it would be nice to have.
But from a content creator's perspective and a producer's perspective, I was looking at it and going, this is so frustrating, because this is the sort of thing the entire world should be absolutely captivated by. And I just don't know why sometimes it doesn't happen.
Because often positivity is not the priority, it's negativity, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, but we've done amazing with what we had. Made the impossible possible.
Yeah.
So that's what matters now.
Exactly.
And now we have a chance to continue to push it, you know.
Yeah.
It will grow more and... Yeah, with the right direction.
Should be so proud of yourself, man. All the team, incredible work.
No,
and
man,
really appreciate your time today.
No, mate, cheers for coming. And if anyone wants to head over and support and donate, please.
Yeah.
After all this, please do just head over to the lovely Instagram page and donate through the link.
Perfect. You can send me the links and I can put it in the description.
Thank you very much, guys.
Look, thank you so much, Mitch. It's been an honor.
I've
been looking forward to doing this pod for a while, because ever since Molly told me about it, I was like, that just sounds like a perfect podcast.
Yeah.
And it's wicked.
It has been.
Yeah.
Cheers.
So excited to share this with the world. And keep doing your thing, man. Keep smashing
Legend.
It.
Cheers,
it's
mate.
Great chatting to you. Thank you guys for listening and or watching. And I'll catch you next week for another episode. All Mitch's links will be in the description. And if you want to let them know where they can find you.
easy as it can be, just Mitch Hutch, M-I-T-C-H, H-U-T-C-H, Instagram, YouTube, same name. Links in the bio for the donation page. Please go over. Yes,
absolutely. Go donate. Mitch, once again, thank you so much, man.
Legend. Thank you.
Take care. Cheers.